He's in there laughing his ass off because he knows more about the law than you do.
I'm here live. I'm not a cat.
My law is thy legal.
I will make it legal.
Objection, Your Honor! Strangling a witness!
I'm going to allow it.
We disagree.
That's it? We disagree?
Well, I can't say we agree. That's how I lost my first 10 cases.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 485. You know, we're closing in on 500, Andrew. We better do something cool. I don't know what.
All right.
We'll figure it out. Well, I'll do a backflip.
I nominate you to do that one.
Not it. Yeah. Only got 15 episodes to try to be able to do a backflip. I'll see if I can. I'll start working on it. I may be broadcasting from one of those cartoon full body casts next time, but I'll have Lydia position the mic real well for me.
You're pretty much broadcasting from one of those already. So
I do play hockey. So yeah. How's it going, everybody? How's it going, Andrew?
Fantastic as always. How's it going with you?
Going great. I'm excited. Great listener questions today. There's so much to talk about. I'm seeing just an absolutely full spreadsheet here, Andrew. So we'll see if you can get through it.
Keep your fingers crossed. But we have a backlog of some really fantastic questions that I thought was high time for us to devote an episode to those listener cues.
Can't wait. Some updates. The Amazon stuff, man. What the heck? I mean, we covered that. I heard it, not just us. Lots of people were covering it, obviously. It was a huge story. And then the unionizing effort was easily defeated. How did that happen?
And to me, it was not, it was defeated 2-1. It's much less the margin of victory by Amazon, which was like 1500 to 750. But the fact that there were 5,000 eligible workers that did not cast a ballot. And there are a ton of stories about the kinds of intimidation that Amazon used in connection with its workers. I am sifting through all that, you know, because look, we don't just sort of report on other people's reports, but putting that into the context of what an employer is permitted to do to rebut when a petition to organize has been made with the NLRB, what remedies the union has with respect to that, because they don't just go away right now. And also something that is very likely to come up in the Senate close to within, you know, when this episode airs, is the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which is backed by President Biden, has passed the House of Representatives. And the question is it going to get past the most conservative members of the Democratic Senate caucus? Joe Manchin has already come out in favor of it, but we are waiting, in addition to, you know, the most predictable, terrible Democrat, Kyrsten Sinema, also Mark Kelly, also from Arizona, and Mark Warner have indicated that they need to be persuaded, at least. So, so we got a show on labor organizing coming up, which I am very, very excited to do.
Well, in better news, I think. you had some bad people getting what's coming to them updates for us.
I do. There's so much here. And again, it's kind of unfolding and we're in the middle. So, you know, we could cover it in the middle or we could sort of wait for whether my predictions come true. But I mean, this is a rogues gallery, you know, who's who. We got the response that Sidney Powell's lawyers filed in the ongoing sanctions case in Wisconsin. Spoiler alert, it's terrible. And two, by the way, because they continue to reply in support of their motion to strike, which is ridiculous. And then they filed, you know, a 25-page opposition to the motion for sanctions on the merits. Spoiler, it talks very little about the merits because they're bad lawyers. We got the MyPillow guy, Mike Lindell, hired Alan Dershowitz to sue Dominion Voting Systems on the grounds that Dominion Voting Systems is the government. Spoiler alert, that's stupid and bad. We have Liberty University is suing Jerry Falwell Jr. That's delightful. There can be no winners in that. We have the U.S. government is pursuing a civil action for tax forfeitures against Roger Stone, which is great because it's not a criminal tax case, right? Like, so civilly, your burden of proof is much lower. So a lot of bad people getting ready to get what's coming to them. So
long overdue on Roger Stone. Holy moly. How is that guy a free man? I don't understand it.
Yeah, hard agree on that. And speaking of, you know, no longer being a free person, a conservative judge, perhaps the most conservative judge in the District Court for the District of Columbia, somebody I have argued and lost in front of, Royce C. Lamberth, revoked Rachel Powell's bail in connection with the insurrection. That's the person who was released on bail, subject to wearing a mask, and then, you know, made that like mesh mask.
Subject to wearing a mask?
Yep. Yep. Huh. And then, you know, wore this like mesh mask and posted about it on right-wing media and was like, ha ha, suckers. Like, you know, I'm wearing it. And the judge was like, no reasonable person would interpret this court's order as saying that you can, you know, wear something that
it's almost
that
like the law isn't magic words with weird tricks and stuff, as we've covered on the show for years now, Andrew.
And by the way, again, cannot be overemphasized, the most conservative judge out there saying, yeah, knock it off. So lots of good news in the sense of bad people getting what's coming to them. And I, for one, could not be more excited to bring that to you.
Well, and by the way, what's coming to them is not even like vindictive, horrible, you know, like what it's just like the barest amount of consequences, you know?
Right. So
these people aren't like a giant rock isn't falling on them. It's like, oh, finally, Roger Stone might lose a little bit of his money for being a criminal this whole time. Crazy. Oh, well.
Yep.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
All right. The first of our fantastic listener question here for this listener question episode, patron Jonathan asks, while it's true that even criminals are entitled to a defense, is it legal for a lawyer to refuse to continue to defend a client once it becomes clear their client is guilty, i.e. before taking the case, the client claimed innocence, but once trial starts, the client admits in private they are guilty, but doesn't change the plea, expecting a defense anyway. So this is the devil's advocate, I think, rule, you know, back when that was one of the early lot awful movies with Heath. This is the when Keanu Reeves realizes Craig T. Nelson actually did kill his wife rule. I think that's what they call it in law school, right?
So let me ask you this, Thomas. What do you think? Let's take the precise parameters here, which is you're the lawyer. Client comes to you and says, I'm innocent and I want you to defend me.
You may remember me from the show Coach. I killed him. That's what they say.
Right. Yeah. Somebody who may or may not be Craig T. Nelson comes to you and says, I want you to defend me. And you take on the representation. And then at some point during the course of the representation, you discover that he had lied to you, and you confront him and he says, yeah, no, you're right. I did do it after all, but I still want you to defend me. What are your thoughts?
Okay. Well, here's something. I know that we've talked about this before and in, I think, some lot awful movies, which, by the way, not just advertising Lot Awful Movies for patrons. They're actually really fun, and I've learned a lot of law from Lot Awful Movies, FYI. And I know that, you know, it's not the easiest thing to just quit representing a client, because obviously there's some interest in the legal system in wanting to make sure people are represented, and it's a tough thing. I think it's a really big burden on the defendant, if they are a defendant, to lose their lawyer in the middle of a thingy. So I think the judge doesn't let you do this willy-nilly. But if I had to guess, I would guess that you would say, like, Your Honor, I can no longer represent this client. And then I imagine that, like, I don't know, if it were a jury trial, for example, I imagine that's a super prejudicial thing. So you'd probably, like, you know, in camera or whatever, you'd have to go, like, tell the judge, like, yeah, here's the thing. He did it, and he's going to make a liar out of me. And I imagine that, like, I don't know, if it was that extreme, I feel like the judge would let you do it, right? But I don't know. What's the right answer here?
Well, I think there are really two separate questions here. The first is, must you withdraw? Hmm. And the second is, if you're comfortable going ahead, right? If you're like, yeah, all right, check's good with me, right?
Well, can you do like a, well, I'll try to get you the lightest sentence, I guess. You know, can you kind of transition into that mode? Or are you required to, like, try to prove their innocence?
So let's talk about that. And I'll give you what I think is the best answer. And again, I want to bracket this by saying that my view of legal ethics is greatly influenced by someone who was a mentor when I was in law school, Alan Dershowitz.
Don't say it. Don't.
Yeah, no. And so if
maybe
you have
re-examine
not,
your ethics.
You know, I these come up as hypotheticals that have not changed much in my career because I don't do, by and large, I don't do criminal cases, right? So I do want to flag that because I want to say I could be wrong about this. This could be too scumbaggy on the side of, you know, representing a guilty client. So let me give you the bottom line. In my view, even in this case where the client lies to you and then changes their story midstream, I do not think as a lawyer you have to withdraw. I do think that you have grounds that you may withdraw on the grounds that, you know, the client has been substantially withholding information. I'm going to go through each of the three applicable rules in the Model Rules of Professional Conduct. That's our legal code of ethics. And I would add, in the case where the client comes to you and says, oh, I'm super guilty, but I want you to get me off, right? Like, you can represent that client as well. I will start with the Dershowitz position is, because things change based on your knowledge as the lawyer, Alan Dershowitz gives as the intro discussion, hey, I don't want you to tell me that you are guilty or innocent. I will never ask you that terminal question, and I do not want you to answer it. Understood? Because that way, as we'll talk about what your requirements are, that makes it easier for you to comply with certain ethical requirements. So first, let's talk about, can you withdraw? I think you can withdraw. And that comes from Rule 1.16 of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct, lawyer-client relationship. And that sets forth, subsection A says, a lawyer shall not represent a client, or when representation is commenced, shall withdraw from the representation if, one, that representation will result in a violation of the rules of professional conduct, two, the lawyer's physical or mental condition materially impairs the lawyer's ability to represent the client, or three, the lawyer is discharged. So those are the cases where you have to withdraw. Hmm. And that first one, by the way, is when the representation, you know, forces you to aid in the commission of a future crime. As long as we're talking about Lot Awful Movies, let's talk about The Firm, right? Like,
yeah.
Oh, hey, Morgan Stringer, Ace Associate. By the way, client number 12397-0001 is the mob. And every month they're going to put in a deposit and we have to launder that money. Thanks. Welcome to The Firm, right? Like, yeah, Morgan gets to withdraw from the case.
What?
withdraw from The Firm and have me arrested, right? Because that is not just you know,
so what you're saying is that Grisham doesn't know how the law works? It's the weirdest thing. It's the weirdest thing.
So weird.
So weird. So those are the three conditions under which you have to withdraw.
Okay.
Right? Ongoing crime, you're not mentally capable, or the client fires you, right? And again, that's something, it's such a trope in movies, but it's so sort of poorly explored. Like, yeah, you know, because it's always this like, you know, heel turn for like 8 seconds. And it's like, I fire you as my, okay, yeah, you can come back. And you know, I think that would be really interesting. Those are the only things that are mandatory into the rules. Here are the permissive. A lawyer may withdraw from representing a client in 7 circumstances. 1, if withdrawal can be accomplished without material adverse effects on the interests of the client. And by the way, like, I read this one first because having been in a non-criminal but similar situation where I had a client, we were about to go to trial. I did not want to represent said client any longer. And what I did was I said, hey, look, like, this lawyer over here is a really, really good lawyer in this area, and you will be well served by, you know, being represented by Ms. Smith over here and not me. So, you know, let's voluntarily part ways. That is the, and I know it's not the answer that Jonathan is looking for, but that's the real answer. If somebody changed horses midstream and was like, hey, by the way, I'm super guilty, the first thing you would do is say, okay, well, you understand that I can't be your lawyer anymore, but let me find you adequate replacement counsel. And that gets you out under number one. Alternatively, and these are all disjunctive, number two, you may withdraw if the client persists in a course of action involving the lawyer's services that the lawyer reasonably believes is criminal or fraudulent. So that is, let's play the scenario out. I say to you, Mr. Smith, you've changed your story. That's fine. I can continue to represent. Let me get you somebody else. And you say, nope, I don't want anybody else. I only want you, Andrew Torres. And I say, okay, well, I've got to change my strategy now, knowing that you're guilty, and we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And you say, nope, I want you to put on my, I want you to put me on the stand and I'm going to insist that I'm innocent. Well, that's fraudulent. I can't do that. That would violate the rules. So I could withdraw by saying, and you'd have to couch it very carefully to the court by saying that the client is persisting in a course of action that I believe is criminal or fraudulent. Third exception is pretty much the same. The client has used the lawyer's services to perpetrate a crime or fraud. Think any episode of Breaking Bad with Saul Goodman in it, right?
Right.
Four, and this is really, I think, where you would go to the court. You know, you would combine. I would be very nervous to go to the court on number two. But number four, the client insists upon taking action that the lawyer considers repugnant or with which the lawyer has a fundamental disagreement. So again, you know, you would say, look, like, no, we're not. I want you to destroy them and let's go to trial and you're going to get me on. I'm going to say to you, no, look, man, you did it. This case is real bad and let's get you the best deal we can. And you say, nope, I refuse to take any deals. And, you know, and then I can go to the court and say, yeah, they want me to consider to go forward with something that's really terrible and is going to result in my client losing at trial and getting a 20-year sentence instead of the 3 years they're being offered. Number five, the client fails substantially to fulfill an obligation to the lawyer regarding the lawyer's services. Hint, paid money. And has been given reasonable warning that the lawyer will withdraw unless the obligation is fulfilled. Now, again, we've talked about that before. These are not all equal, right? And the court will often say, you know, we're 3 days from the end of trial. Mr. Torres, you're going to continue for the next 3 days. I don't care that, you know, you haven't been paid in a year and a half. Number six, the representation will result in an unreasonable financial burden on the lawyer or has been rendered unreasonably difficult by the client. Same thing. Or number seven, other good cause for withdrawal exists. So that's sort of how the voluntary withdrawal would work. You don't have to stop representing the client, but in that kind of situation, you probably meet the criteria for being able to say, hey, look, like there's just a fundamental disagreement on how to proceed. And why would there be that fundamental disagreement? Here, this is the clash between Rule 1.3, which is the duty of zealous advocacy, and Rule 3.3, which is the duty of candor to the court. So 1.3, zealous advocacy, you may be surprised, Thomas, to know that this is the sum of the rule. A lawyer shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client. That's literally all it says. Yeah.
Okay.
So all of the, like, I have a duty to do the utmost to my client. Well, you know, that's not what the rules say. It is what many lawyers personally will say. And I will often say this, you know, to my clients, like, I take very seriously and will always act in the best interest of the client. In particular, I say this and I mean it when I represent a business entity, a corporation or an LLC, right? Because I'll be talking to the partners and I will say, you'll notice my engagement letter is on behalf of Smith Corp LLC, and that means that I am obligated to look out for the best interests of Smith Corp, and that means even as against the two of you. So when we go forward, you know, we're going to talk about the things that I'm going to do on behalf of Smith Corp, and one of it is to keep it safe from the two of you bickering and squandering all of the assets of this going business, right? So you may feel different ethical obligations to your client. But the model rules say you should act with reasonable diligence and promptness. And that's, and then there, you know, there's some notes that say, you know, a lawyer should pursue a matter on behalf of a client despite opposition, obstruction, or personal inconvenience to the lawyer, and take whatever lawful and ethical measures are required to vindicate a client's cause or endeavor. So, you know, that's kind of where how the concept of zealous advocacy is embedded into the ethical rules. And I will tell you, these cases and the rules, far more so than the, like, you know, criminal, you know, he did it, can I do it? Like, what they really focus on and what is a major problem for lawyers is they focus on workload, procrastination. Right? Did you miss deadlines? Hmm. Did you do the stuff for your client at the time that you said you would? And it turns out that's a really big deal in terms of professional conduct. So it's less glamorous, but again, it's another kind of candidate for our real life Laud awful movie. Laud great movie, I should say. Now you match all that up against what Rule 3.3 says, which is, a lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement of fact or law to a tribunal, or fail to correct a false material statement of material fact or law previously made to the tribunal by the lawyer, right? Or, and then we're going to skip some other stuff, offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. And then the rule says, right? If a lawyer, the lawyer's client, or a witness called by the lawyer has offered material evidence and the lawyer comes to know of its falsity, the lawyer shall take reasonable remedial measures, including, if necessary, disclosure to the tribunal. A lawyer may refuse to offer evidence other than testimony of a defendant in a criminal matter that the lawyer reasonably believes is false. So that's pretty unambiguous, and they write it into the rules that say, you know, you may not suborn perjury. And, you know, when somebody says to you, and think about, like, what's suborning perjury, right? That the lawyer knows to be false, right? So, you know, Thomas, you hire me, you say, yes, I definitely stabbed Morgan at, you know, 5 p.m. on December 5th, 2021. This is perspective. We're coming back from the future for this. Not only can I not put you on the stand and say, Mr. Smith, did you stab Morgan? Right. Like, and elicit a perjurious response. But I now can't put an alibi witness on the stand, because if the alibi witness says, you know, your brother says, oh, you know, December 5th, Thomas was with me the whole time. You know, he got super rip roaring drunk and spent the night. That's how I know he was there the whole day of December 5th and all of December 6th. It was a bad hangover. And in fact, into part of December 7th, I can't put Sam on the stand because I know he's lying, because I know you weren't there because you told me you killed Morgan. So yeah, really does constrain your ability to be an effective advocate once you know that your client has committed the murder. I leave open for discussion. I will tell you again, the Dershowitz solution is don't ask that question.
Yeah, which feels like kind of just a cheap way to get around having any ethics, doesn't it?
I know that it would come off that way. And again, subject to all the caveats.
Especially
I said
now that we've learned that Dershowitz is a snake.
Yep. The counter argument is, no, the rules say I may not offer evidence that I know to be false. I may offer evidence that I suspect to be false. You know, I throw that out there.
You just really lawyered the lawyer rules about being a lawyer is what you're saying.
Yeah, indeed. So I love that question, and hopefully we did a good deep dive on it.
We got pretty far afield from Craig T. Nelson. What happens? What was the answer?
So what happens is if I am comfortable continuing to represent Craig T. Nelson, that will confine the ways in which I may do so, right? Okay. I may not offer testimony that I know to be false. I can't elicit, you know, the we switched from Craig T. Nelson to Thomas Smith, so it's my and who
never
can blame
do
me?
That.
You're
never
so interchangeable.
From Craig T. Nelson to Thomas.
If I want to withdraw, there probably will be grounds because I will probably want to withdraw because Craig T. Nelson is no longer taking
my
advice.
About that process? I mean, it's not a casual thing, right?
You are 100% correct. And it's not, and again, that's why I emphasize that it's in the permissible phase, right? Mm-hmm. Like the court gets to decide whether you can withdraw or not. And that can be a challenge. And they will weigh the harm, the prejudice to the defendant about you withdrawing. Now, that's why, Your Honor, my client will no longer listen to my advice or follow my instructions is usually a really strong argument. And it's not hard to get from there to the client firing you, right?
Yeah. Well, we could have also, while we're on the actors thing, we could have talked about the Robert Duvall rule of this client will not listen to me and wants to just give a speech in front of the court, probably involving the gold fringe on the flag, I'm guessing.
Yeah. The hobo army rule. Yeah.
More a lot awful movies fun.
Oh, man. So good. All right. But there we go. Thank you. Hopefully we did justice to that.
Time for our next one. Brian asks, you mentioned the bane of my existence, the Janus decision. I am a union leader representing public employees. This was topic number one at my union for many years, both before and after this decision came down. What always struck me in the decision was that they completely disregarded Garcetti v. Ceballos. I'm not sure how you'd pronounce that. I am not a lawyer, but do you think my analysis is correct? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So love this question. Janus versus Ask Me. We've talked about this a lot, most recently in our discussion of originalism. And it is sort of the obvious example because there was a previous Supreme Court case from 50 years ago on the exact same facts from 40 years previously called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education that said, yeah, a hard case, but not that hard. Abood was a 9-0 decision that says, unions, where they are required to represent an entire bargaining population within public sector unions, can be required because they are required to represent everybody. They can spread their administrative, right, but not their political lobbying costs to non-members who are beneficiaries of the class. That was pitted against the free speech rights of the non-members to not have to pay their money to be associated with political positions that the union would take. The Supreme Court in 1977 said, yeah, well, we get it. There is some sort of association here, but no, the larger idea of vindicating the collective bargaining rights, right, of allowing by statute. And again, right, you could pass a law that stopped that, but we're not going to say that constitutionally you have some kind of inherent free speech right that trumps the reasonable ability of a democratic populace to say, we're going to let people collectively bargain. And if we don't spread the costs, then you quickly eviscerate the strength of the union by encouraging free ridership, right? If they have to bargain on behalf of you anyway, no matter what, and they can't spread any cost to you, well then, right, the economic rational decision is for everybody to withdraw from the union, not pay any dues, and then be like, okay, go ahead, represent us. We voted you in. And in fact, that is why conservatives want to do this, right? So that's Janice. Great question, because when this was litigated before the Supreme Court, the response was not just, hey, you decided this case and it controls. That was the first line of response. But also, and by the way, you got it right the first time around, because the free speech rights of the public union participants here are less than free speech in general. And one of the cases routinely cited in the briefs and distinguished, by the way, in the Janus decision. So when Brian says they disregarded Garcetti versus Ceballos or Ceballos, that does not mean that the case doesn't mention the Garcetti case. It does. Oh, I should add just for you, Thomas, that is Gil Garcetti and not Mayor Eric Garcetti.
Oh, it's his dad.
Yeah. And this, by the way, is a conservative 5-4 opinion that ruled that public officials have a lesser expectation of their free speech rights. So, facts of the case. Ceballos, longstanding deputy district attorney. There's a particular prosecution. He gets contacted by a defense attorney that says, hey man, in this case, you executed a search warrant. It was supported by this particular affidavit, and you should know there are a lot of problems with that affidavit, and that the things that are said are patently not true. And then so Ceballos investigated that, right? Did what a good district attorney should do, looked at it and said, okay, is this affidavit, okay, got an outside tip, says the affidavit's full of lies. Is that the case? And he went and investigated it personally and came to the conclusion, you're right. This affidavit seems not great. And so he submitted a memorandum to his superior and said, we should dismiss this case. The facts underlying getting this search warrant are not as they appear to be. It looks like there were major misrepresentations by the officers and other problems. So we should not go ahead. Then there were a couple meetings, and as you might imagine, Ceballos' superior not very happy about this. And so the prosecutor decided that they were going to go ahead with the case anyway. And then the defense called Ceballos as a defense witness. And then that was part of a hearing as to whether to exclude the warrant. So Ceballos came in and testified for the defense adverse to his own office. By the way, did not result in getting the affidavit thrown out. So, you know, we talk about like deference to police and the like, another data point here. And then Ceballos said, look, I was subjected to retaliatory attacks the moment that I testified. This is not hard to imagine, right?
Yeah.
And I'll quote from the case. These actions included reassignment from his calendar deputy position to a trial deputy position, transfer to another courthouse, denial of a promotion. He then initiated an employment grievance, which was denied based on a finding that he had not suffered any retaliation. That's internally. So then he sued under Section 1983. He said, you have violated my First Amendment rights to free speech by retaliating against that in the course of my employment. And the Supreme Court said, I mean, first I should say the Court of Appeals said, okay, we should strike the balance here that your First Amendment rights, Ceballos' First Amendment rights, were clearly established, that the petitioner's actions, that is, that the district attorney's office's actions, were not objectively reasonable. And then the Supreme Court granted cert and reversed. And they said, yes, it was. A public employee's speech is deprived of First Amendment protection whenever those views are expressed to government workers or others pursuant to an employment responsibility. And that was 5-4, right? Scathing liberal dissent from Justice Souter that said public employees have just as many free speech rights as private sector employees. That, you know, we should, you don't lose that simply by virtue of serving the public. And the majority opinion was like, well, yeah, you kind of do. And so what I love, so now put that back into context here. Absolutely, this decision was relied on heavily by the state of Illinois on appeal at the Supreme Court and rejected by the majority opinion in Janus, which is, you know, the argument was, right, look, we've said this is a tough case. We've said you've got multiple interests at stake here. And Supreme Court, if you're not persuaded by the fact that you've already ruled on this case 40 years ago, and we're guessing you're not because you're filled with activist howler monkeys, in evaluating the relative rights at stake, keep in mind that you were talking about the ancillary monetary free speech component of public sector employees. And by the way, this court said a decade ago that public sector employees get less free speech rights than everybody else. But the Supreme Court crafted a little exception to that and was like, well, no. What we were really saying in Garcetti was that you're more responsible for speech that is related to your profession, right? That is related to your job duties. And giving money to the unions is somehow a different kind. Like, that's not speech that is related to your job duties. How that is, I don't know. They just say that it isn't. So yes, I wanted to validate you, listener Brian, not a lawyer. Really excellent to go back and get the free speech case that we have not talked about in the context of Janus, and to show the sort of originalism lets you have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah. Originalism lets you have your cake and not make it for a gay person too, as that should be the phrase.
yes. But yeah, when back in Garcetti, the conservative outcome was, yeah, of course you should be able to retaliate against that prosecutor for telling the truth to defense counsel. That was the result they were able to reach. And doesn't that suggest that the free speech rights are not like, you know, this flaming pillar in the sky that Sam Alito describes in the Janus opinion? Well, on that. So, so great question. And there's our little breakdown.
All right. French listener. Oh, great. Is this more bonkaverms? Well, let's find out. And patron Adrian asks, could you expand on why you think one electoral vote equals one person and the constitutional issues with fractional allocation? The Supreme Court has ruled that electors are not free to vote, but are legally obliged to just report what their state told them to. To me, it's just a small step to say that they can report fractions of vote if their state tells them to. That being said, I'm from a country with national popular vote for the president, and the Electoral College seems bizarre and outdated.
Yeah, thanks for rubbing it in.
Outdated is a weird word for something that never made sense, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed. And despite rubbing it in there, Adrian, I do want to answer your question. So first, let me correct a little bit of the premise. The Supreme Court in the Baca decision did not rule that mandatorily electors are not free to vote. What they ruled was that state laws that direct an elector to vote in a particular way are constitutional, right? But states are not required to pass those kinds of laws. So in other words, you know, those were the faithless elector cases brought by our friend Larry Lessig. And the ruling was not that electors must vote a certain way. It was states can legitimately tell electors to vote a certain way and thus prohibit by statute faithless electors. So I think that's an important distinction. Here's why I don't think that matters in my analysis of Lessig's fractional allocation, right? Which, you know, again, the idea was to compel, or is, right? The cases are pending, to compel a state to allocate fractionally the proportion of the votes multiplied by the number of electoral votes to those candidates. So if you get 49% of the vote and the state has 10 electoral votes, you get 4.9 electoral votes. I initially said thought in evaluating that proposal that you'd round up to five. And it was pointed out to me that Nona Lessig's argument is you get 4.9. I think that faces major constitutional hurdles on the text of the Constitution. So again, you know, we get to go back to, you know, the straw man of originalism, like, wow, you're just making up stuff. No. Like, you look to the text first. Anyway.
Yeah.
So here are the things. Number one, the Constitution does not mention electoral votes at all. It mentions electors, meaning people, who then cast a vote, which is in the singular, for a candidate, which is in the singular. So it does not make sense to me to tabulate a fraction of a person. And we know that it does not comply with the text to say, right? Like, if an elector were to say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to vote and half of my vote is going to go to Clinton and half of my vote is going to go to Trump, right? That makes no sense, right? Like, you can't split a single person's unsplittable vote.
Well, shoot, is this a constitutional argument against ranked choice voting?
Let's table that. I hadn't thought about that question. I don't think that it is, even at the constitutional level, because what you would do is you would resolve the ranked choice before it gets to the casting of the electoral vote. It certainly is another good argument against having an electoral college, which, you know, I don't know that we need any more of those.
Yeah, but there are no good arguments for having an electoral college.
There are not. So that's the answer. I thought that this was a good and a good one to end on because we, you know, it doesn't require a lot of deep dive. but those are the difficulties that I see in fashioning a fractional allocation. Is it seems to conflict with the plain meaning of the original words in the Constitution. And having said that, I want to give ammunition for all of our originalist listeners to come back and say, see, you're an originalist after all. So Professor Bode, that one's for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like you said, we broke down in these originalist episodes, it's not about all the easy cases. You know, it's not that everybody on Andrew's side of the argument is like, whatever the Constitution says, we just get to make up what we think it means. You know, like it's there are plenty of clear cut cases. And I think you're right, Andrew. This seems pretty tough to argue with that. You do go to the language of the Constitution first, right? It's not like you completely disregard that in your jurisprudence.
Exactly right.
All right. Well, thanks for the great questions. And reminder, those were patron questions. Andrew said last episode, the good way to get them answered is to send us a patron message, but also email can work. And we're just amazed we have so many smart listeners with so many amazing questions. So thanks very much for that.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3B answer time. Real proper Tay. Here we go.
Nothing like a real property question to pork a bad streak. This was two sisters own a single tract of land as tenants in common. They each own one half of an interest. The younger sister enters into a 3-year lease with a tenant for a particular portion of the land, which is about 40% of the total tract. And then there is a meets and bounds description dividing out the land. And then that tenant goes into sole possession of the leased portion of the land. The older sister sues the younger sister and the tenant to establish the older sister's right to possess that leased portion of the land. Who is likely to prevail? And you did the thing I love in answering the question. You said, I want to pick the older sister prevailing, right? That's the A and B answers. And I'm going to eliminate the C and D answers. The idea that the younger sister would prevail in partitioning and leasing out the property. And I want to tell you, good elimination.
All right.
So the only question is it A, that the older sister will prevail because the younger sister cannot unilaterally partition the land without the older sister's consent? Or is it B, the older sister because the younger sister may not lease her interest, her undivided interest in the land without the older sister's consent? You picked B, thinking that B was sort of more inclusive. And the answer is A. Yeah. Here's why. Okay.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, no, you were fairly warned up front that it's a real property question and real property is tough. There are three different ways. and you started off, you were like, I don't know what tenancy in common is, but it's probably like Lydia and I own my house. It's actually not. But so here's the thing. It's a way that you and Lydia could own your house, but I am almost certain, almost positive that you and Lydia own your house as tenants by the entirety. And that is one of the three ways that multiple people can own the same piece of property. So you can be joint tenants, you can be tenants in common, or you can have a tenancy by the entirety. And tenancy by the entirety is a special rule that applies only to married couples. So, and what really happens is a question of survivorship. So tenancy by the entirety for married couples says you die, Lydia gets the house, Lydia dies, you get the house, right? Regardless of whether you have a will or not.
So I can't even will it out to anybody else. I can't be like... if the marriage is on the rocks, I can't be like, I will this house to Andrew.
Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Take marriage advice from a podcast.
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
Okay.
Now, so the difference, so leave aside tenancy by the entirety, it's kind of a corner case. The difference between a joint tenancy or a tenancy in common is also on this survivorship. So if you are joint tenants and one of you dies, then the other person is entitled to the entirety of the property. If you are tenants in common, then during your lifetime, you both have a right to possess the property, but you have a specified percentage interest in the property itself. Okay. And by the way, doesn't have to be 50-50. That's why it says they each hold one half interest, because that's the key to a tenancy in common. We could enter into a tenancy in common in which you have a 99% interest and I have a 1% interest. And that means we both have a right to occupy the property at the same time. And if you want to kick me out of the property, you have to pay me to surrender my right to the property, or you can petition for us to partition the property according to our ownership interests. And if we can't come up with an agreement, then we go to court. So that also gets around the, like, I own 1% of the property, but I take the most valuable 1% and partition that for myself. And the other 99% goes to you, but it's all the scrub brush and garbage. I own a 1% interest in the property. So it provides with the unique situation where a tenant in common, because you and I own the property in common, that means I have the right to live there. It also means I have the right to lease out my right to live there to somebody else. Uh-huh. So what the sister did that was wrong here was not entering into a lease without the consent of the older sister. Mm-hmm. That's totally fine. It was partitioning off the 40% of the property and kicking the older sister out. And so you notice the specific grammar of the question says to establish the older sister's right to possession of the leased portion of the land. That doesn't mean kicking out the tenant. That means the older sister also has a right to be on that.
And I got all that. I just thought if B was also true, then it would have kicked into effect kind of before this and would have been the better answer. But B is just not true. So
yeah. And this is another one of those bar questions where it represents something that is not remotely possible in reality, because you're sitting there and you're about to ask the question wait a minute. You're saying that I can lease it out without, you and I jointly own this property. You own 1% in the property. And Andrew, you can lease out your right to occupy the property to somebody else. And it's like, yeah, I can, but I can't promise the tenant an exclusive right to the property. Right. So, I'd be like, okay, Morgan, I got a great piece of property that I'm going to lease to you. And she's going to say, fantastic. And I'm going to say, now it's possible that Thomas Smith may wander through the property at all hours, right?
Yeah.
Is that cool for you?
I like to pretend I'm a ghost and just do some casual haunting. Just for fun. Who doesn't?
And she's going to say, no, like, When
I don't know. I feel like Morgan would be cool with it, but I get your point. I get your point. Right, most people wouldn't.
Most people would say, I would like an exclusive right to the place that I'm going to rent. And I would say, oh, well, yeah, I can't give you that.
I can't give you that. Okay.
And so then, you know, that's what prevents. This is a hard one. That's what practically prevents you from younger sistering it here. So hard question, good answer, but just
Thomas's
not quite
second right. chance, still in the 90s, I think, probably.
Yeah, absolutely.
But getting that last frickin' step is very difficult.
I know.
It's especially difficult on the new porked exam. I used to be able to do it 52% of the time or something. Now I do it 0% of the time. Pretty cool. Should I start flipping a coin on second chance? Should I second chance it and then just flip a coin and just then I'll justify it after the fact and be like, yep, that's the reason, because, and then I'll come up with a reason. I mean, honestly, that might be a better test taking method. Like, I could at least hope for 50%. Serious question, should I start
I feel as the test administrator that I'm ethically prohibited.
You know what
from,
I should, here's what we do. To Gomes. Okay, we're going to keep two sets of books. Here's what we're going to do. I'll do it the normal way, and then after I do that, I'll flip a coin, and we'll see if I can beat the coin. We'll have the Thomas second chance, we'll have the Thomas answer, and then we'll have the coin answer, and then we'll see what the coin gets. Okay. Starting from here on out, if I remember next week, that's what we're going to do.
Well, you heard it here, folks. A new add-on to the T3BE segment. I can't wait. I'm looking forward to it.
You don't sound nearly as excited about this design. That's okay.
I love it.
Here's something you're excited about. Tell us who is this week's big winner.
Well, Thomas, got to be honest with you. A lot of people had trouble with this question. There were a lot of incorrect answers. I'm going to pick a winner this time from the Opening Arguments Facebook community, because I don't know that we've done that before. And if you haven't, head on over to facebook.com/groups/Yodel Mountain. It's a fantastic place. We got about 5,000 folks who are really enjoying hanging out together. And there's a great discussion on the T3BE question. The winner is the original poster, Timothy Knoll, who says, I think Thomas was on the right track when he was analogizing the question with his wife. You can tell your spouse to stay out of your man cave all you want, but ultimately it's their property also. The tenant taking sole possession of the divided property limits the access to one of the rightful owners. The answer is A. Pretty good answer. Again, there's a specific type of property that likely covers when you have a husband and wife owning a parcel of real property. But I'm giving you full credit for the use of the word analogize, and you got it exactly right. There's a fun discussion under that. Congratulations, Timothy Knoll, on being this week's winner.
And thank you!
And now it's time to thank our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats on patreon.com/law. And it's my turn to go first. Of course, this is where we do the shout outs to our top patrons each and every week. And they usually give us something really funny or fun to say. Here we go. Thank you to Sean McGovern, John Brockman, Lisa. See you at the next True Crime Podcast Festival. Tell Morgan, Gatom's son, Amy Hensley, January 20, baby. Matt Gates eats his chicken wings with ranch. Zach Bloom, any chance of an Optimus Prime v Negatron debate soon? Ray, Legal Eagle is so handsome. Cecil said Tom would officiate my wedding, I'm pretty sure. California employment, work, accident, or litigation questions, call or text attorney David Nitka, 310-776-5879. Again, 310-776-5879. Richard Scott, The Smiths, Chris Kaiser, Brian K., Thomas, you are a fop doodle and a gnash gab. I bite my thumb at thee. Praise be unto Hamilton. Tell Morgan guitar. Actually, never mind. Remind Morgan that Sparkle Donkey is the world's best tequila in the world. Nice. I like it. Fort Teaser. Two Virginians and an immigrant walk into a room. Diametrically opposed foes. Das Rook. Listening for years. Still can't come up with something clever. The Texas outages were caused by gerrymandering. Rest in peace, Brandon Bernard. We must abolish the death penalty. Adam Borchoff, Justice for Beer, The Coterie, Business Success with Salesforce, find us at thecoterie.io. Budget Botanist on Fiverr, in honor of Porking the Streak, the first ever plant of the week is the Peter Pepper. Oh, cool. We got our plant of the week, Andrew. Ooh. This is an exciting announcement.
I've never had a plant Peter of the Pepper. Week before.
They say Google it. Okay, we'll Google the Peter Pepper. Level up canine. We will train Lily at the next live show.
Oh,
wow. Wow. That sounds like a Platinum Night special event, yeah. You know? Becoming a patron. Well, does this suggest that Lily is not properly trained? Is that a slight to you, the lovely Lily?
I choose to interpret it in a positive sense to get okay. even more trained.
How even more that? Trained. Gotcha. Becoming a patron to get 5 episodes a week, and I finally caught up on months of backlog. New book, The Greatest Gift of All, A Logical Path from Religion to Humanism by Mark McLean, out now. One UUU instant, choose two, draw a card. Well, this is, of course, Cryptic Command, one of my favorite cards of all time. Draw a card, counter target spell, tap all opponent's creatures, or return target permanent to its owner's hand. That's a great one. Thanks for continuing to pick ones I can get. I don't say evasion, I say avoision. Why aren't we calling the January 6th insurrection an act of treason? Oh, speaking of, act of treason. Did we already do that one? That's another magic card we could do. Did we do that one? I can't remember. Anyway, getting stabbed on Friday, but like in a good way. I like my pork streaks paired with Casa Agria and Emperor's Brewery beer. Josh Hawley's dorm room poster. Lee Sharp, under strict originalism, states can pass any gun control they want because incorporation fails under originalism.
Ooh.
Very interesting. G.D. Tree says, Parliamentary Bird Watchers Society. Thomas Kleberg, please donate to the Trevor Project at trevorproject.org. There are a lot of LGBTQ plus kids in a damn scary place right now. Buddy freaking Geyerson just got his freaking second Pfizer shot.
All right.
A-T-A-G-T-S, my podcast fam. Aw. I'm very honored to be included in that. What a nice podcast fam. If Trump gets indicted, Sassy Italy Tours wants Andrew to come to our World HQ on the Eastern Shore for some Barolo. Idea for a screenplay, Air Bud, Man's Best Amicus. Hard on. Good luck to all studying and taking law school finals, aka not updating my Patreon for several weeks. Yeah, fair. Two fabulous lesbians who wish all people who have a dog named Lily a fantastic week. Edgy Veggie, Bob Newhouse, me fail bar exam, that's unlegal. One Smart Cookie, Scent Cutters, Ledo, Lebion, Fabulo, Jennifer Chakowski, Justice for George, now let's get to work, a string of unconstitutional laws. Maybe if we just call that place Dakota Territory again, they will stop sending people to D.C. Mike Hall, sorry, Andrew, Uncle Frank is too far gone. Say it with me, amicus. The Books That Burn podcast, reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019. Nuzzly Fuzzly Torsten Peel of the Satanic Temple. Yes, I'm not even a tortfeasor and I'm kicking your ass. Crimer, no criming. Angry Macface. Penelope is sad. Penelope is glad Sydney got sanctioned for terpsichore. T-I-L, if a horse isn't from the Champagne region of France, it has to be called a sparkling donkey. We'll change this Patreon name when our newborn lets us sleep. Please thank Andrew Seidel for all that sweet, sweet, for all the sweet, sweet lemon torts. Ace Associate, Morgan Stringer, makes my heart smile. Beers in the beer fridge, torts in the tort freezer. Ritz of Mandamus in the Ritz cellar. Cool glass of motion in lemony, waiting for you on the porch. Another week down, another week I forgot to change my Patreon name. Murray Gregerson, congrats to my sister on her new position in Illinois. Love, GT. Cool. Simple Country Hyper Chicken. Crazy Corgi. Y'all should have watched The Ginger Dead Man instead. No law, but way better. Yeah. No reasonable person could believe I wanted to sell that baby. Plug whatever you guys want here. I don't listen anyways. Patron benefits rule. Brent Medling, Seattle Pete, Jake, Medicon 7, another Minneapolitan waiting for our live show in Minneapolis. And Andrew Torres says my briefs are where the magic happens. Your turn.
Woo! Thank you to Christopher Brown, to a fabulous single French lesbian waiting for her microchip. I need better 5G. To Philly Live Show 2022, I'll bring the scotch and cheese steaks. I'm there. Lawful Copter says, Andrew and Thomas, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for everything you guys do. That gets me every time, man. I won't change my name till Thomas Pork something. A man was sued after his snapping turtle attacked someone. They sued for tortoise interference. Fan with an unreasonable obsession with Andrew Seidel's butt. Like, is it unreasonable? I don't know. We'll have to revisit that. Odin's last week of law school. Congratulations. Polly Hernandez, Robert M. Vini, Vidi, Pro Hoc Vice. MC Hammer and Sickle, too legit to quit seizing the means of corruption. I love that name. That is such a fantastic interlay level of puns. Love it. Aspen Live Show. Yeah, probably not an Aspen Live Show. Calling for a You're Wrong About crossover episode. It's the only way I can convert my sister to your podcast. Yeah, I'm down on that. Ian Hamilton, The Reasons I Suck at My Job, volume GI through GM. Jason Kopas, that's a big Twinkie. Excellent Ghostbusters 2 reference there. Emily Rainbow Spence, Hotspur's Ode to a Small Lump of Filibuster I Found in My Armpit One Midsummer Morning. Earth Court 7, Judge Dred Scott. That's pretty good. This profile name is hilarious in the context of some other podcast. A Series of Houses, Each More Glass Than the Last. Nate Trex, Not That Chris Wallace. Darth Mandy Pants, Sidney Powell, Kraken at Large. GiveToModestNeeds.org, GiveToModestNeeds.org. Seriously, GiveToModestNeeds.org. Jennifer Cratch, Reality is Getting Stranger by the Day. There's also a brief trial of Cobra Commander in the G.I. Joe movie, Lamb Double Feature with Transformers. Oh, I am down. Oh, come on, Thomas. You can't deny me that. I am the one thing in life I can control. Sure. Dude. Mike Hudson, this podcast's sluttiest patron since 2016. Well, that
there's big competition for that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, we gotta open that one up. Don't take legal advice from a cat. Good advice. CivilPoliticsRadio.com. Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. John Bilderbeck. My friend's cousin mixed Coke and with Pop Rocks and he died. Yeah. Mixed Coke and Pop Rocks. It's delicious. Stephen Balticate Sandoval. I am the very model of a hobo army general. That is so good. Yeah. Philip Kaiser. Andrea the Arbitrary and Capricious. It's spring and time for me brew much beer. All hail beer. Run, 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 just as fast as you can. You can't rent me. I'm the gingerbread man.
You know, someone commented that apparently they're like, oh, what? You can rent it easily. And I think they're in a different country. Yeah. So, because they said you can rent it for like, you know, one whatever, some other currency. And so I think that maybe this is an American thing. They try to get rid of it in America, but in other countries, they still have it.
One Czechoslovakian dollar.
Yeah.
Absion, Alfred Wallace, Payne Strumpet. Never underestimate the perversity of machinery or the machinery of perversity. Jonathan, Trump wanted four seasons, got Doubletree. Karaoke legend Cosmo, cue music. I was born in a hospital in Norwood, Massachusetts, blues. Just this guy, you know. Well, all right, thanks, Zaphod. Milo Meadsong pronounces it Hobetian. Join your labor union together. We bargain alone. We beg. Clean up serious opening beans in space live show in Chicago. Got kicked out of a flat earthers group for asking if COVID restrictions had pushed anyone over the edge. It's excellent. Glad the blue line broke. I'm a cop and I applaud these verdicts. Well, good for you. False. If D&D Minus wants to try the alien RPG, I will run it. Anonymous, wordorigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. My witty names aren't original and my original names aren't witty. Nerdgnostic, RIP, notorious RBG. Our kitchen is your kitchen for an eventual Seattle live show platinum dinner. The offer stands. Ooh. They said I could be anything, so I became two fabulous lesbians. Derek, I don't pray, but when I do, it's for evangelicals to get vaccinated. Big easy blasphemy. It's kind of nice having a competent federal government again, thanks to SummitShuffleboard.com. A string of unpronounceable characters. Rhonda the Dork.com. HPL is my favorite racist science fiction author. PKD is a close second. Malaika Chandler, Tricicular Manslaughter. Soggy Pants, this leftist textualist says the Fourth Amendment already prohibits civil asset forfeiture. Well, that's a super interesting question. Adam Costa, J. Alden Walt, gravity sucks. Adopt a homeless pet in a pose, declawing and ear docking. De jury belly at Packies at last, baby. Heather L., Matthew Vernon, I am the host of this show, and my favorite two things are Hamilton and Pearl Jam. That is such a genius burn on both of us.
It's designed to get either of us when we read it. Yeah.
Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Ian and Allie, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, David in Brooklyn, Please Hobo Army, Rescue Me from Texas, Sam Danal, Mitchell, No Commute, So Behind on Podcasts. Fun fact, you're more likely to get a virus from a religious site than a porn site. I'm all for visiting porn sites. For a great history of policing in the U.S., listen to Behind the Bastards, June 16th, 2020. Love Behind the Bastards. Wish Robert Evans would return my messages. So Natasha Crunchwrap wants you to support the Justice Policy Institute. Sam Buck, and of course, our all-time great, he who shall never be overthrown, Conrad Michaels.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. We will see you for Rapid Response Friday. Take care.
You're damn right.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.